It's the extreme of capitalism having produced its own negation, its own opposition, its own self-destruction that calls forth the fascist alternative to come in there and deal with things.
Professor Richard Wolff on fascism and capitalism.
The far right, groups like the Proud Boys, the Three Percenters, neo-fascist group, Aryan groups, white supremacists are overwhelmingly armed. We cannot cede the territory of the ability to defend our communities and our unions and working peoples to the state alone. We have to be willing to step up and defend ourselves if that time comes.
David Van Dusen, the president of the Vermont AFL-CIO.
The only opposition to fascism was social revolution. The only way to avoid Nazism and the Second World War would have been to support the Spanish Revolution, the French Revolution of 36, the Austrian 34. So only sector able and capable to fight fascism is, of course, the organized working classes.
And from Lisbon, Portugal, Raquel Varela on opposing fascism. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and radio affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Steve Zeltzer. The rise of right-wing and fascist movements is a growing danger globally. Today, we will speak to noted scholars about the history of fascist movements and the danger of a new one taking hold and what we should do. But first, we go to Siberia, Russia, where we interviewed Boris Kargalitsky, a Moscow professor and social scientist. He is also editor of RobCor, or Workers' Correspondence, on YouTube. Kargalitsky talks about the growing opposition of the war inside Russia, as Communist Party representatives in parliament from Siberia have also spoken out against the invasion.
It's very clear that these people in the Kremlin, they kind of lost control over the events and over, in a certain sense, over their own actions. Because I think they started with bluffing and they lost control. And at this point, the situation is extremely chaotic because I think Putin's entourage and he himself, they are kind of panicking and their behavior is totally hysterical. Why? Because honestly, you should not just blame Russia for what's happening, because part of the blame on the Ukrainian leadership and part of the blame should be on American leadership and on the West. Anyhow, the situation was created not just by Russia alone. However, at this particular point, it is Russia which is actually taking military action against Ukraine, and including Ukrainian civilians. And of course, there is a peace movement in Russia which opposes these activities, opposes these actions. There is a slogan, No to War, which is very popular. We have anti-war demonstrations daily. Well, so far, Russian internet still enjoys considerable freedom, so people speak out quite vocally and quite actively against the war. We continue receiving information from Ukraine and from the West so that people are more or less informed about what's really happening on the ground in Ukraine. So I think there is a very strong anti-war sentiment. And of course, as with every war, there are some chauvinism and some so-called patriots who are very happy with the war. But it's general mood in the society is different. People are worried, scared, confused, and getting more and more scared and confused by the day. Again, the left is kind of split, as it happened like with the First World War, with every big war, it happens time and again, that of course some people are supporting their own government, no matter what it does to other people, to other countries. And of course, there is an internationalist left which is opposing the war, which is actually gaining ground because there are at least three Communist Party deputies who have spoken against the war. Matveyev, Smolin, and Levchenko, three CP deputies. And by the way, even though, of course, the Communist Party leadership is behaving quite predictably, in a very opportunistic way, so that they basically supported the war action against Ukraine, the CP is the only parliamentary party where there was at least a group of MPs which spoke against the war. So there is enough resistance to the war. So anti-war movement is real, and it's gaining ground.
You're saying that the government, the Putin government and the military, did not expect the resistance in Ukraine that they're having. Were they prepared, and are they prepared for an occupation of Ukraine?
No, they're totally unprepared. There are reports from the military that they have shortages of necessary resources, of they don't get enough fuel for the tanks. They don't even have enough ammunition for their guns and cannons and so on. So there are already military complaining that they were sent there without adequate supplies, because everybody expected them just to walk into the country and everybody would be praising them and meeting them with flowers. And instead, they were met with bullets. And they were totally unprepared. They just simply didn't have enough ammunition and fuel for real fighting.
That was Boris Kargalitsky in Moscow. You can hear our full conversation at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Today we will look at the actual history of fascism in Italy, Germany, and Spain to analyze the positions and prospects of fascism in the U.S. today. Here's Professor Richard Wolff, Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and currently a visiting professor in the Graduate Program in International Affairs of the New School in New York.
We are the year 2022. 100 years ago, 1922, is when fascism really begins in Europe. 1922 is the year of something called the March on Rome. It was October of 1922 when Mussolini led the March on Rome and took over in what was basically a coup d'etat, taking over the Italian government. And he then instituted a fascist regime. It lasted from 1922 until around 1944. At that point, it came to an end, and Mr. Mussolini was hung upside down in the street and killed by the people that he had led, which tells you something about fascism. Hopefully, you will remember. The next case of fascism happens 11 years later. It's January 1933, and in Germany, the government there turns itself over. Didn't require quite the coup d'etat, but it took not that different a form, turned the government over to the leader of a fascist political party, like Mussolini in Italy, only his name was Adolf Hitler, and he was head of the Nazi party. And a few years later, in 1936, a democratically elected government in Spain was overthrown by an illegal military revolt of General Franco, who waged a civil war, displaced that government and established Spanish fascism, which lasted several decades. And then he died. And Spain reverted back to a non-fascist arrangement. Those are the three major fascisms we know about. And what I'm about to tell you is what we know from what they actually did. Before each of them, capitalism, the dominant economic system in each of those three countries, was content with and satisfied with what we are familiar with as parliamentary democratic government. You know, elections every year, people elected to one or two house legislature, like our Congress, and going about the normal business of running a capitalist society. Everybody gets to vote. We pay a lot of attention. But the people with the money, the capitalists, the wealthy, the big CEOs, they run the show because they donate to the parties. They donate to the candidates. Their lobbyists help write the laws. We're all familiar with that because we're used to that here too. The problem is, in each of those countries, the capitalism that was normally perfectly happy with conventional representative electoral democracy was falling apart. the capitalism was producing such suffering, such anger, such bitterness among the mass of people that there was a developing anti-capitalist movement. And this scared the capitalist class, the owners of the enterprises, the big CEOs. They could see the handwriting on the wall. In Italy, just before fascism, you had the greatest general strike in the history of the country in Torino, led by a then obscure communist named Antonio Gramsci, who becomes one of the great communist theoreticians of the 20th century. Terrified people. In 1917, a few years before, an anti-capitalist revolution in Russia succeeded. Terrified capitalists everywhere in the world, here in the U.S. too. So there was this sense it's falling apart, our system. And when that happens, there's a strong push, doesn't always succeed, but a strong push to push aside representative democracy, all of that, and have the iron heel, the iron fist. Change the government from that game to one where its job is to control the society, repress every critic of capitalism you can find, do it all in the name of the race or the nation or patriotism to give it all a better sounding name than saying we're going to save capitalism by crushing everybody who disagrees with it, everybody who has turned against it. So it is done in the name of, well, the nation, nationalism. It's a good way of covering it over. Everything we're doing is not about preserving capitalism. That's a real agenda. It's about preserving the nature or preserving white America, if you bring it over into us, or preserving the Italian soul, or preserving genuine Spain, whatever it was always the same. And here's what it involved. You crush the labor unions. You either kill them, that happened often, jail them, exile them, no more labor unions, unless the fascist party owns and operates the unions. You go after the socialists, you go after the communists. But don't be fooled. Underneath the veneer of the government coming in is the ultimate purpose: protect capitalism. That's why it's there. That's why this is done. It's the extreme of capitalism having produced its own negation, its own opposition, its own self-destruction that calls forth the fascist alternative to come in there and deal with things in that harshness that has nothing to do with the old convention. So don't be surprised if you hear the American version of all of this. Here's how it works. Mr. Trump and the people around him are saying, well, we have to exalt the nation. Mussolini promised to make Italy great again. Hitler promised to make Germany great again. Franco promised to make Spain great again. Hint! Mr. Trump promises to make it again. And he declares who's not really quite part of the nation. That's people who aren't white. You don't have to be too subtle to get the parallels here. But now let's look at the opposition to Mr. Trump, because there's a lesson there too. When the folks around Mr. Biden tell us that they are protecting democracy by focusing, for example, on the January 6th activities of the Trump people around the Capitol in Washington, I know what they mean. They want the elections to go on. But if you look at it historically, what you're really getting is a demand for how things were before. It's a demand of people who don't want to see or face that capitalism is in deep trouble. And if something isn't done about that, the turn towards fascism will only accumulate more steam, more support, more momentum. Against Mussolini, there were Italians who wanted to protect parliamentary democracy in Italy. they lost. Against Hitler, there were all kinds of liberal Germans who wanted to protect their parliamentary democracy. They lost. The same thing, the government in Spain wanted to continue to be a representative electorate, and they were destroyed. This is a problem. The problem is the debate about protecting democracy versus protecting the nation, the racial soul, the Aryan, whatever it be. These are disguises for two alternative ways of protecting capitalism. But because they can't say that, and because they can't really face it, they can't deal with it either. So the problem keeps getting worse. That's why Americans rightly have the sense that the underlying difficulties keep getting worse. Our job situation, our income situation, the fact that the shelves in our supermarkets can't be maintained. These are all signs of a system that isn't working, and Americans know it. Trump promised everything, delivered very little. The gap between rich and poor got much worse under Trump. It is getting worse under Biden. They're not dealing with the underlying problems, and those are at root what is shaking this system to the foundation. Glorifying the nation and using that to come down, will that happen in the United States? It certainly may. It certainly may. That is the historical pattern. We are not exempt from that. All those other societies thought they were. In Germany, for example, they had one of the most powerful labor movements, socialist movements, communist movements in the world. That's where Marx comes from, Germany. That's where the Socialist Party got bigger and stronger. In the years before Hitler took power, socialist and communist parties together got half the vote in every election in Germany. That's why they scared the capitalists. They scared them. And so they went and chose what for them was the only way they could be sure they would survive. The democratic system that they had supported wasn't anymore the guarantor as it had been. So they opted for the fascist solution. Why would you imagine that American capitalists, also confronted by a system that is not only breaking down, but is generating a greater degree of questioning and opposition to capitalism than we've seen in this country since when? Since the 1930s. And what was that period? Gee, that was the breakdown of capitalism that likewise generated a powerful anti-capitalist thrust in American society. So yeah, we are at a crossroads in our society. Fascism is one solution that the capitalist may opt for. And the real political question is whether an opposition to that solution is possible. Saying we want to protect democracy, go back to the way things were, I frankly don't think that's an available option. And that means maybe the time has come when the left has to be able to say, we really do want not to save capitalism, but to go to a new, different, and better system. Because saving capitalism has had this 100-year history from the March on Rome fascist solution to the present moment when we face something so very similar.
That was Professor Richard D. Wolff speaking on a recent episode of his weekly Pacifica Hour Economic Update, a Democracy at Work production.
Una mattina mi sono alzato, oh bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. Una mattina mi sono alzato e ho trovato l'invasor. Oh partigiano, portami via. Oh bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, 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 partigiano, portami via, che mi sento di morire. E se io muoio da partigiano, o la ciao, ve la ciao, ve la ciao, ciao, ciao. E se io muoio da partigiano, tu mi devi seppellire.
That was Bella Ciao by Manu Pilas. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm the host, Steve Zeltzer. Raquel Varela is a professor with the Institute of Contemporary History in Lisbon, Portugal. She is an expert on working people in the global economy.
I believe to understand what is fascism, we have to look to history, but we also have to stop mix all kinds of concepts. Mm-hmm. Because we have Bonapartist regimes, which are extremely violent, and they forbidden individual liberties, the right to have a party, the right to speak, etc. But they are not fascists. And what we see, I'm not sure if we are seeing in the world a growing of fascist movements. Certainly what we have is an increasing of extreme right parties or organizations that have in some cases, massive support in the polls. Why I'm saying this? Because when we speak about fascism, we speak about mobilization of the masses, and we speak about a certain type of regime. And what we see nowadays, we don't see, neither we saw in Trump, not even in Bolsonaro. I don't know very well what's going on with the extreme right regimes in Eastern Europe, but we don't see strong, rooted, social-based, right-wing movements that support this. In my opinion, although it can be that some of these organisms exist, for example, in France, we saw youth extreme right organizations persecuting refugees that were trying to cross the Alps to survive. So here is a kind of type that you see a rooted, based organization. Most of the cases, what you see is extreme right has an electoral impact, massive electoral impact in some cases, but not ability to massively organize the society. And the reflection of this extreme right has been much more through the media and in some cases through their electoral impact rather than through social bases organized. So we don't see big unions controlled by the extreme right. We don't see big associations controlled by the extreme right. But in some cases, we see extreme right movements rooted, for example, in religious movements, ultra-Catholic movements, as you have in US in some cases, in Brazil, in Pentecostal movements, or in India, the Modi regime. So we see it apparently some cases there are root bases, but most of them they are not. Why this is important to debate what's going on nowadays? Because we are facing a reorganization of a sector of the right wing, no doubt in my opinion about this. This is a worldwide movement. I'm certain, because all the documents and evidence show it, that Steve Bannon has tried to reorganize the extreme right with impact, probably even in Portugal, in the new extreme right party in Portugal. So they use very similar methods of organization, propaganda. So all these things that people think that are very odd or very exceptional, like being brutal, say scandalous things, etc. This is all in Steve Bannon notes. How to organize. So there is no news about this. But what we see above all is, so it's a movement who has, until now, it has not been easy for this extreme right movement to gain roots. Why I'm saying this? Well, because it has been, since 2008, the neoliberal speech by the left, socialists, social democrats, or the liberals, so the left neoliberals and the right-wing neoliberals, all the speech has been saying, look, it's bad with us, but we'll be even worse with them. So here comes the fascism. If you don't eat the neoliberal soup, then you have the fascism. So the fascism is like the, you should all support neoliberal governments, either liberal or more left, in order to avoid fascism. This has been the big speech. But what we have seen in the last years is that in most of the countries, the extreme right was not so easy for them to organize in big social movements. They have tried to do it with Gilets Jaunes, the yellow vests, and they were expelled from the movement. So most of the movement didn't want them there. They now try to run the Freedom Convoy in Canada, but most of the Freedom Convoy, until I saw now the truck drivers, they were clearly about against vaccine restrictions, but not supporting any kind of extreme right ideas. So a huge part of this movement already reject these ideas. We saw this in strikes, like in England, the sector strike oil refinery after 2008. Also, the British National Party tried to pick up the results of the strike because they were contesting social dumping with workers from foreign countries. And we saw that it was not so easy to convince workers or big social movements to support extreme right. So I'm very concerned with the extreme right increase, but I do not think that until now they have won nothing similar like this. What I believe is that the left has committed a huge number of errors that give space to these extreme right wing sectors. And we can talk about these errors afterward on the history of fascism. To make it simple, the idea that fascism would be a kind of an anti-capitalist, anti-liberal view of the society that avoids progress, extremely nationalist, based on the racism, of course, division of sectors and ethnic divisions, etc. So the idea that fascism was something that was coming from the past. And there was a big debate among socialists in the 30s, what would be fascism? And there was another answer at the time from the left opposition to the Soviet Union, which was Trotsky's, but not just Trotsky's, saying, look, fascism is not about the past that is coming to us. It's the most developed sectors of the bourgeoisie that are supporting fascism. It's not just the Junkers, it's not just the old military, it's not just the old aristocracy. There is an important sector of the bourgeoisie when she feels that she's frightened by social conflicts, class struggle, radical strikes, they prefer to support militias, because this is what is about fascism. That's why I wanted to start speaking about masses involvement or not. So fascism is about when you use militias to repress and kill the leaderships of the labor movement, unions and political parties, you use these militias. So all the fascist regime, the first fascist militias that appear were the Fasci di Combattimento in Italy against the workers' occupation in 1919-1920. Then it was the 30s, then in Germany, etc. But these militias, they are used by the dictatorships in certain moments to destroy the labor movement. But then they don't want the militias as well. They want to control all the power. But there is a moment where a regime is threatened by a social revolution, it's a moment when the bourgeoisie uses militias to do this. I shall advise to our listeners a much more easier explanation of what I said, of a wonderful movie recently done, which is there. It's The Good Boss with Javier Bardem. It's a wonderful movie that is there. Please go to see it, because with a wonderful story, with a wonderful acting, exactly what is fascism is explained there.
And fascism as a movement during the 30s and 40s, what gave rise to fascism? Why did fascism was successful? And the crisis now in social democracy and in the liberal Democrats or the Democratic Party, they have no solution. Is this the situation we're in today internationally?
Well, I don't think we are experiencing the same situation as in the 30s. We can learn, especially the concept and theory of the 30s, but we are certain in different times.
Why don't we talk about those lessons of the 30s of fascism and,
well, I think
and the crisis
today?
One of the
basic lessons is that you don't fight fascism supporting social democracy. You fight fascism supporting social revolution. The only opposition to fascism was social revolution. The only way to avoid Nazism and the Second World War would have been to support the Spanish Revolution, the French Revolution of 36, the Austrian 34. So only sector able and capable to fight fascism is, of course, the organized working classes. So this is the basic lessons of the 30s. I think what has happened in the Soviet Union in the 30s, which was the opposite of supporting social revolution, was in fact a self-defense impossible idea of socialism in one country that, of course, has degenerated in a bureaucratic dictatorship, trying to save a bureaucratic sector of the party in name of the workers, but against the workers, so it was not a workers' regime, showed exactly that the only solution that can avoid, it looks like a very pamphletary answer, but if you think about that, the Russian Revolution has brought the biggest hopes to the world, the biggest rights, the biggest scientific in poetry, in painting, in psychology, in physics, in all the things you can imagine, the explosion of energy of the Russian Revolution. And this was destroyed because it was very backward country and they needed the German Revolution. They needed countries where there was development of the productive forces. In order to have socialism, you have to have abundance. You have to have huge production to give very good life to everyone. And Soviet Union could not deliver this without the developed country support. There was no, well, there was a revolution in Germany defeated. And this helped to the success of the Stalinist counter-revolution. But the success of the counter-revolution of Stalin also helped the defeat of the social revolution and the end of the Weimar Republic. So we have to think in the history as a process. One very good example is the revolution in France, which is very commonly forgotten, which is the Popular Front of 36, where hundreds of companies were occupied by workers' control and the result were paid, holidays, increasing wage, etc., etc., and a support of the workers' organization to a liberal bourgeoisie government. This liberal bourgeoisie government, some months, 2 years after, was invaded by the Nazi German, and they had to escape, and Leon Blum ended up in a concentration camp. So some sectors of the social democracy have contributed to destroy the labor movement, as they have contributed to the assassination of Rosa Luxemburg, for example. But some sectors of the social democracy are serious people that believe in democracy and social rights. And these sectors that want, in any cost, to avoid social revolution end up assassinated by the fascists as well. This has happened in Germany, this has happened in France, this has happened in Republican Spain. So the idea that we have to support moderate governments to fight fascism is a totally wrong idea. What we need to support is democratic workers' organizations to fight fascism. There is no other way to fight it. The idea that comes a very educated liberal man saying defending labor rights will save us from fascism is absolutely ridiculous. It means that you know nothing about history.
That was Professor Raquel Varela with the Institute of Contemporary History in Lisbon. That was All You Fascists by Billy Bragg and Wilco. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Steve Zeltzer. I spoke with Chris Hedges about the U.S. empire in decline and the resulting danger of a fascist movement.
The rise of fascism is serious, and I agree with you that there's likelihood of another coup attempt, maybe successful coup attempt in the United States. Yet it seems that the working class here, the unions, are embedded in the Democratic Party, part and parcel of the Democratic Party. There is no mass working class party. The rise of fascism, how is it going to be challenged without a development, political development in the working class in the United States?
It isn't, but let's remember, we don't have any unions. Come on, what, 11% of the American workforce is unionized. I think 6%, is that right, is in the public sector. We don't have any unions. Our unions were destroyed, and then all sorts of bills like the Taft-Hartley Act makes it impossible for right to work laws. They can't, the capitalist class has quite effectively crushed unions quite consciously because that is collective organized power that frightens them. So you have a resurgence among some, you know, fast food workers, the nurses union, but in essence, the American working class, number one, doesn't have unions. And number two, with deindustrialization, doesn't have jobs. Or they have temp jobs, you know, they're in the gig economy, they're driving Uber cabs or something. But this is, you know, without adequate compensation, without the right to organize. So we don't have any unions. I mean, we have to almost start from scratch. We don't have the kind of militant unions that forced Roosevelt to pass the New Deal, the CEO, the Wobblies, and let's not write out the Communist Party. The Communist Party was a major force, partly because it was so well organized. With evictions in cities, they'd come to evict you, and next thing you know, they'd run down to the Communist Party headquarters in a city like Chicago or somewhere. Everybody'd say, "Let's get the Reds," and they'd stop them. That's kind of where we have to get back to, but we're very far from that.
Well, isn't that part of the problem within the unions, because the AFL-CIO actually was a creature of capitalism, the witch hunts, sanitizing the unions, get leftist militants, communists out of the unions and bring in corporatist union officials who support labor management, collaboration, business unionism, and also were involved in U.S. intervention internationally with the AIFLD.
Yeah. No, you're
Irving,
right.
Irving Brown and actually organizing internationally to support right-wing corporatist unions around the world.
Yeah. So they destroyed radical militant unions like the Wobblies, you know, Joe Hill, driving Big Bill Haywood into exile, et cetera. And then they created essentially, yes, corporate-friendly unions, Cold War. That's how you had in the 60s, George Meany and Lane Kirkland and everybody getting up and backing Nixon's war in Indochina and denouncing the hippies in the streets. So essentially severing what was left of the union movement from that radical grassroots was a very effective strategy. If you go back and look at the strikes in West Virginia at the turn of the century, which culminated in Blair Mountain, largest armed uprising by Americans against the government since the Civil War, their hero was Mother Jones. They had a kind of radical ideology. Yeah. So yes, what's left of the union movement, and there isn't much left, it has been for a long time completely co-opted.
And this hollowing out of America, deindustrialization, supported by the Democrats and Republicans, gave rise to a decline in living standards of the working class, and were one of the reasons for the rise of Trump and these right-wing forces. So This decline of U.S. imperialism now and its inability to challenge China to operate internationally, where do you see that going? Because it seems like Trump escalated that decline of U.S. imperialism, and Biden is not able to really resurrect the hegemony of U.S. imperialism internationally.
I wouldn't say that Trump escalated it. I would say it was already in free fall before Trump took office. I think it really began with, you know, the invasions and disastrous interventions, largely, you know, after Bush, run by Obama and Hillary Clinton. I mean, remember that they're the people who bequeathed us Libya and Syria.
They were bringing democracy to the world.
Well, they, I don't know if they believe that. So I wouldn't pin it on Trump. This is a long trajectory. Trump was kind of powerless to affect it. You just can't challenge the deep state, which is real and powerful. I mean, where is it headed? Well, it's headed where every late stage empire is headed, which is towards internal collapse. You know, I studied classics, the late Roman Empire, the differences. Of course, Rome was a slave-based society, but there are many similarities between the collapse of the Roman Empire. Trump, you know, is our kind of Nero or whatever, and he won't be the last. I covered the war in the former Yugoslavia, which was triggered by the economic collapse of Yugoslavia. It vomited up these figures like Radovan Karadzic and Slobodan Milosevic and Franjo Tuđman. And in the same way that Weimar vomited up the Nazis, these buffoonish figures that are dangerous. You know, so there's a kind of comic opera quality to them within the inner circuits of power, but the ramifications of what they do is deadly. So that's where we're headed. That's where we're going. And Joseph Tainer in The Collapse of Complex Societies, I think it was 24 civilizations, he tried to pinpoint the kinds of forces that herald the end of a civilization. Well, we've ticked all of them off, including the, you know, the overreach of empire, the extreme use of force. Never forget that empire is just the external expression of white supremacy. But it's the same disease because we're, of course, attacking, demeaning, dehumanizing people of color, Latin America, the Middle East, Vietnam, wherever else the empire, you know, wades into a conflict. And then to maintain the empire, you hollow the country out from the inside. Thucydides writes about this in the Peloponnesian War when he says that the tyranny that Athens imposed on others, it finally imposed on itself. That's what's happened.
That was author Chris Hedges talking about the U.S. empire in decline. I spoke with David Van Dusen, the president of the Vermont AFL-CIO, about the dangers of fascism and what his labor federation is doing about it.
Anybody that's paying any attention at all must be acutely aware that the fascism represents a serious threat to our very way of life here in the United States and is on the rise. What we saw happen with the authoritarian attempts by the Trump and his allies to stay in power after losing an election is a good example of that. And what they would like to do is limit our ability for regular people, working people to have a say in society, to consolidate power and to use tools such as racism, discrimination, and various notions that divide us as the way to build wedges between working people, to keep us divided, to keep the few in power as opposed to the many. So we have to be massively concerned about this. And just because Trump is, for now, out of power, does not mean that the danger has particularly diminished. I had a very good one-on-one conversation at some length with President Shuler not very long ago, where she very bluntly expressed her continuing concerns about democracy in our country and it being eroded. With that being said, I would say to anybody that would listen, we cannot rely on the Democratic Party at all. The Democratic Party is inept when it comes to realizing what the real danger is here. They overestimate their own strength. They overestimate their own ability to play defense. And we see that even with them in charge of both Congress and the White House, our voting rights have been eroded in dozens of states across this country, massively eroded. So if we put our eggs in the basket of the Democratic Party, that's just a recipe for failure. Organized labor must rely on itself. Here in Vermont, we've done three things that we should be doing nationally as a labor movement to defend our communities against fascism. Number one, when the time came and when democracy was under threat of a potential coup, we went to our members, and our members, by overwhelming numbers, authorized us to call for a general strike should there not be a democratic transfer of power on January 20th, as our Constitution demanded. And that was number one. Number two, we have chartered an anti-fascist motorcycle club here in Vermont to act as an appendage to our sergeant-at-arms to help provide security to our unions and to the labor movement as needed going forward. That's something that's important that we do across this country as well. And number three, we went to our members and they overwhelmingly passed at our last convention a position whereby we now oppose gun control. And let me explain to you what I mean by this, Steve. The far right, groups like the Proud Boys, the Three Percenters, neo-fascist group, Aryan groups, white supremacists are overwhelmingly armed. And as we saw, people like Trump are willing to tell them to stand by and take action, as we saw on January 6th, when they see it in their right-wing self-interest. We cannot cede the territory of the ability to defend our communities and our unions and working peoples to the state alone. We have to be willing to step up and defend ourselves if that time comes. So those three concrete steps show how serious the Vermont AFL-CIO, our 11,000 members, take the threat of fascism in this country. And we will do what has to be done to defend democracy here in Vermont and beyond.
That was David Van Dusen, the president of the Vermont AFL-CIO, speaking on what labor should do about the rise of fascism. That was Take the Power Back by Rage Against the Machine. Next, this editorial from Jan Spencer of Pacifica affiliate KEPW in Eugene, Oregon, talks about the nature of capitalism.
This is Jan Spencer coming to you from Eugene, Oregon. You can follow up with this audio essay at my website, suburbanpermaculture.org. Capitalism and its most impressive product, the consumer culture, is the common denominator for many of the nation's and world's biggest problems, social, environmental, economic, and spiritual. The consumer culture is one of history's greatest examples of social engineering. We live in a cargo cult. It's easy to be critical of capitalism, but deep criticism deserves a convincing analysis. But a deep analysis of capitalism does not require great academic capacity. Capitalism's self-promotion and claims are remarkably shallow. Most of us grew up with capitalism. In my own nothing unusual public schooling, our American exceptionalism was repeated over and over and never questioned. It was all about growth and development. We lived in a bountiful country, we were told, full of resources, and Americans were very good at turning nature into money. Our wealth was equated with virtue. In the fifth grade in Dallas, Texas, we learned two songs in music class, Texas or Texas, the state anthem, and You're from Big D, that's Dallas. The state anthem celebrated grandeur, empire, and growing in power and worth throughout the ages long. You're from Big D boasted about Dallas, where every home's a palace, because the settlers settle for no less. Capitalism has a raft of dishonest mythologies, and its abundant distractions, typically referred to as entertainment, have short-circuited critical thinking. Few people seem to have much thought that there might be alternatives to an economic system that thrives on and promotes overconsumption and vanity, along with a social system that looks something like neo-feudalism. We're told about the invisible hand of the marketplace. That myth goes like this. Through individual self-interest and freedom of production and consumption, the best interests of society as a whole are fulfilled. This assumption is so ill-conceived, it's breathtaking. Do we really need to list the social and environmental problems that are the product of unlimited self-interest, production, and consumption? Two examples will suffice. One is climate change, and the other is the fact that something like 1% of the population owns and controls something like 40% of the nation's wealth. Capitalism claims that informing the customer about its products and letting the customer choose what best fits their needs is a sacred act. That brings to mind an economic practice called externalizing the cost. Every economist will agree an external cost is where the price we pay does not account for the damage of production, use, and disposal that product or service imposes on people and planet. What we typically pay at the register severely undervalues the natural world and social well-being. If all damage to public health and the environment are considered, for example, the cost of a gallon of gasoline would range from $20 to $30, depending on metrics. Capitalism claims to be the most efficient way to allocate resources. It is the opposite of efficient. A 2-ton vehicle used to move a 200-pound load is grossly inefficient. The urban footprint of car-centric, profit-driven Atlanta is 25 times that of densely populated Barcelona. The cities have roughly the same population, but vastly different levels of efficiency and impacts on the environment and social well-being. Consider the great variety of jobs in the economy. With a few moments of thoughtful reflection, we will realize tens of millions of jobs exist to repair the damage caused by tens of millions of other jobs. The misuse of time, talent, and resources could not be less efficient. In effect, external costs and its degraded people and planet amounts to a forced donation, amounting to many hundreds of billions of dollars each year to subsidize corporate profits. Capitalism could not survive if it were honest, and we're told this is a healthy economy. Capitalism reveals its social engineering credentials by referring to people as consumers, not as citizens. A healthy society would not accept the title consumer culture, nor fully participate in such an economic system. A healthy society would push back when it realizes the economic system that controls it has a set of goals that are deeply at odds with the well-being of society and the environment. What might pushback look like? Movements such as climate justice, Occupy, Black Lives Matter, indigenous land rights, the environment, social and labor justice, and many others are all on the same team. The sooner they learn to effectively work together to create alternatives to capitalism as we know it, the better. A broad united front with a shared mission statement and common set of goals would be a great start for pushback for moving towards a preferred future. For more details, podcasts, and links about taking positive actions in our own lives for moving towards a preferred future, please check my website, suburbanpermaculture.org.
That was Jan Spencer from Pacifica, affiliate KEPW in Eugene, Oregon. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by Steve Zeltzer with production assistance from Ann Garrison and Polina Vasilyev. Our executive producers are Akua Holt, Polina Vasilyev, and Steve Zeltzer. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button You can follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID, Race, and Democracy. I've been your host, Steve Zeltzer. Thanks for listening.